and Robert and I can get married, I'll forgive anything, Joy said. Ah, yes. He turned briefly to Chubb. We have two young people who are evidently very much in love. It has been clear to me how much this marriage means to both of them. And good luck to them, Chubb muttered. If you know who did it, why don't you tell us? Robert Blakiston had spoken for the first time, and there was a quiet venom in his voice. Then Joy and I can leave. I've already decided we're not going to stay in Saxby-on-Avon. I can't stand the place. We're going to find somewhere far away and start again. We'll be all right if we're together. Joy reached out and touched his hand. Then I will begin, Hunt said. He drew his hand away from the desk and rested it on the arm of his chair. Even before I arrived in Saxby-on-Avon, when I read of the murder of Sir Magnus in the Times newspaper, I was aware that I was dealing with a strange coincidence. A housekeeper falls to her death in what appears to be a straightforward domestic accident, and then, not 2 weeks later, a man who employed her also dies, and this time it is unmistakably a murder of the most gruesome sort. I say that it is a coincidence, but what I mean is in fact quite the opposite. There must be a reason why these two events have collided, so to speak, but what is it? Could there be a single motive for the death of both Sir Magnus Pye and his housekeeper? What end could be achieved if they were both put out of the way? Briefly, Punt's eyes burned into the two young people sitting in front of him. It did occur to me that the marriage of which you spoke and which you both desired so fervently might provide a motive. We know that for reasons that may be distasteful, Mary Blakiston was opposed to the union. But I have dismissed this line of thought. First, she had no power to prevent the marriage, at least so far as we know. So there was no reason to kill her. Also, there is no evidence to suggest that Sir Magnus was concerned one way or another. Indeed, he had always been amicably disposed towards Mary Blakiston's son and would surely wish to see it go ahead. He knew about the marriage, Robert said. He didn't have any objections at all. Why would he have? Joy is a wonderful girl, and you're right. He was always kind to me. He wanted me to be happy. I agree. But if we cannot find a single reason for the two deaths, what are the alternatives? Could there have been two murderers in Saxby-on-Avon, acting independently of each other, with two quite different sets of motivation? That sounds a little unlikely, to say the least. Or could it be that one death was in some way the cause of the other? We now know that Mary Blakiston collected many secrets about the lives of the villagers. Did she know something about somebody that put her in danger? And had she perhaps told Sir Magnus? Let us not forget that he was her closest confidant. And while I was turning these matters over in my mind, there was a third crime that presented itself to me. For on the evening of Mary Blakiston's funeral, somebody broke into Pye Hall. It seemed to be an ordinary burglary, but in a month in which two people die, nothing is ordinary anymore. This was soon proven to be the case, for although one silver buckle was sold in London, the rest of the proceeds were merely thrown in the lake. Why was that? Was the burglar disturbed, or did he have some other aim? Could it be that he simply wished to remove the silver rather than to profit from it? You mean it was some sort of provocation? Chubb asked. Sir Magnus was proud of his Roman silver. It was part of his legacy. It could have been taken simply to spite him. That thought did occur to me, Detective Inspector. Punt leant forward. There was one other aspect of the case that I found very difficult to understand, he said, and that was the attitude of Mary Blakiston. I never understood her either, Robert muttered. Let us examine her relationship with you. She loses one son in a tragic accident, and this makes her watchful, domineering, over-possessive. You know that I met with your father? Robert stared. When? Yesterday. My colleague, Fraser, drove me to his home in Cardiff, and he told me a great deal that was of interest. After the death of your brother, Tom, your mother closed in on you. Even he was not to be allowed to come near you. She could not bear having you out of her sight, and so, for example, she was angry when you chose to go to Bristol. It was the only time that she argued with Sir Magnus, who had all the time concerned himself with your well-being. All of this makes sense. A woman who has lost one child will quite naturally become obsessive about the other. I can also understand how that relationship can become uncomfortable and even poisonous. The arguments between you were natural. It is very sad, but inevitable. But this is what I do not understand. Why was she so opposed to the marriage? It makes no sense. Her son has found, if I may say so, a charming companion in Miss Sunderling. Here is a local girl from a good family. Her father is a fireman. She works in a doctor's surgery. She does not intend to take Robert away from the village. It is a perfect match. And yet, from the very start, Mary Blakiston responds only with hostility. Why?
Joy blushed.
I have no idea, Mr. Punt.
Well, we can help you there, Miss Sunderling, Chubb cut in. You have a brother with Down syndrome.
Paul? What's he got to do with it?
Mrs. Blakiston set down her thoughts in a diary that we found. She had some idea that the condition would be passed on to any grandchildren you might have. That was her problem.
Punt shook his head.
I'm sorry, Detective Inspector, he said, but I do not agree. She made it clear enough from where I'm standing, Mr. Punt. This awful sickness infecting her family. Horrible words, but that's exactly what she wrote. They are words that you may have misinterpreted.
Punt sighed.
In order to understand Mary Blakiston, it is necessary to go back in time, the defining moment in her life.
He glanced at Robert.
I hope it will not distress you, Mr. Blakiston. I am referring to the death of your brother.
I've lived with it most of my life, Robert said. There's nothing you can say that will upset me now.
There are several aspects of the accident that I find puzzling. Let me begin for a moment with your mother's reaction to what happened. I cannot understand a woman who continues to live at the very scene where it took place, where she lost her child. Every day she walks past that lake, and I have to ask myself, is she punishing herself for something she has done? Or for something that she knows? Could it be that she has been driven by a sense of guilt ever since that dreadful day? I visited the lodge and tried to imagine what it might be like for her, and indeed for you, living together in that grim place, surrounded by trees, permanently in shadow. The house did not yield many secrets, but there was one mystery. A room on the second floor that your mother kept locked.
Why?
What had been the purpose of that room? And why did she never go in there? There was little that remained in the room, a bed and a table, and inside the table, the collar of a dog that had also died.
That was Bella, Robert said.
Yes, Bella had been a gift from your father to your brother, and Sir Magnus did not like having it on his land. When I spoke to your father yesterday, he suggested that Sir Magnus had killed the dog in the cruelest possible way. I could not be sure of the truth of that, but I will tell you what I thought. Your brother drowns. Your mother falls down the stairs. Sir Magnus is brutally killed. And now we have Bella, a crossbreed, who had her throat cut. It is another violent death to add to the veritable catalogue of violent deaths that we find at Pye Hall. Why was the collar of the dog kept here? There was something else about the room that I noticed immediately. It was the only one in the house that had a view of the lake. That in itself I thought most significant. Next, I asked myself, for what purpose was the room used when Mary Blakiston lived at the lodge? I had assumed, incorrectly, that it was the bedroom used either by yourself or by your brother. It was my mother's sewing room, Robert said. I'd have told you that if you'd asked me. I did not need to ask you. You mentioned to me that you and your brother had a game in which you knocked on the walls of your bedrooms, sending each other codes. You must therefore have had adjoining rooms, and so it followed that the room across the corridor must have had another purpose. Your mother did a lot of sewing, and it seemed very likely to me that this was where she liked to work. That's all very well, Mr. Punt, Chubb said, but I don't see where it gets us. We are almost there, Detective Inspector. But first, let me examine the accident as it happened, for, as I have already stated, that too presents certain problems. According to the testimony of both Robert and his father, Tom was searching for a piece of gold, which was in fact in the bulrushes beside the water, because that is where Sir Magnus had hidden it. Now, let us remember, he was not a small child. He was 12 years old. He was intelligent. I have to ask you, would he have entered the cold and muddy water in the belief that the gold was there? From what I understand, the games that the two boys played were very formal. They were organized by Sir Magnus, who concealed the treasure and provided specific clues. If Tom was beside the lake, he might well have worked out where the gold was to be found, but there was no need to walk right past it into the lake. That makes no sense at all. And there is another detail also that troubles me. Brent, the groundsman, discovered the body. He was always skulking around, Robert cut in. Tom and I were afraid of him. I am willing to believe it, but there is now a question that I wish to put to you. Brent was very precise in his description. He pulled your brother out of the water and laid him on the ground. You arrived moments later. And what reason could there be for you to plunge into the water yourself? I wanted to help. Of course, but your brother was already out of the water. Your father said he was lying on dry land. Why would you want to make yourself cold and wet? Robert frowned. I don't know what you want me to say, Mr. Pound. I was 14 years old. I don't even remember what happened, really. I was only thinking about Tom, getting him out of the water. There was nothing else in my mind. No, Robert, I think there was. I think you wanted to disguise the fact that you were already wet yourself. The entire room seemed to come to a halt, as if it were a piece of film caught in a projector. Even outside, in the street, nothing moved. Why would he want to do that? Joy asked. There was a slight tremor in her voice. Because he had been fighting with his brother beside the lake a few moments before. He had killed his brother by drowning him. That's not true! Robert's eyes blazed. For a moment, Fraser thought he was going to leap out of his chair, and he readied himself to go to Punt's rescue if need be. So much of what I say is based upon conjecture, Punt said, and trust me, when I say I do not hold you entirely responsible for a crime that you committed as a child. But let us look at the evidence. A dog is given to your brother, not to you. It dies in terrible circumstances. You and your brother search for a piece of gold. He finds it, not you. And this time, it is he who is punished. Your father told me that you and Tom fought often, He worried about you because of your moods, the way you would take yourself off for solitary walks, even at so young an age. He did not see what your mother had seen, that from the time of your birth, a difficult birth, there was something wrong with you, that you were prepared to kill.
No, Mr. Pund. This time it was Joy who protested. You're not talking about Robert. Robert's nothing like that.
Robert is very much like that, Miss Sunderling. You yourself told me what a difficult time he had at school. He did not make friends easily. The other children mistrusted him. Perhaps they were aware that there was something not quite right. And on the one occasion when he had left home when he was working in Bristol, he became involved in a violent altercation which led to his arrest and a night in jail.
He broke the other chap's jaw and three of his ribs, Chubb added. He had evidently been checking the files.
It is my belief that Mary Blakiston knew very well the nature of her older son, Punt went on. And the simple truth is that she was not protecting him from the outside world. She was protecting the world from him. She had known, or suspected, what had happened to the dog, Bella. Why else had she kept the collar? She had seen what had happened at the lake. Yes, sitting at her table in the sewing room, she had watched as Robert killed Tom, angry that it was his little brother who had found the gold, and not he. And from that day on, she built a wall around him. Matthew Blakiston told us that she pulled up the drawbridge. She would not allow him to come close to Robert, but he did not understand why. She did not want him to learn the truth. And now we can understand, Miss Sunderling, the reason why she was so hostile to the idea of your marriage. Once again, it was not your suitability as a wife that concerned her. She knew her son for what he was, and she was determined that he would not become a husband. As for your brother, who is afflicted with Down syndrome, you completely misunderstood what she meant. She made a significant entry in her diary. All the time I was thinking about this awful sickness infecting her family. I fear both James Fraser and Inspector Chubb misconstrued what she had written. The sickness that she referred to was the madness of her son. And she feared that it might one day in the future infect Miss Sunderling's family should the marriage be allowed to go ahead.
I'm leaving, Robert Blakiston got to his feet. I don't have to listen to any more of this nonsense.
You're staying right where you are, Chubb told him. There are two men on the other side of that door, and you're not going anywhere until Mr. Punt has finished.
Robert looked around him wildly.
So what other theories do you have, Mr. Pound? Are you going to say I killed my mother to stop her talking? Is that what you think?
No, Mr. Blakiston. I know perfectly well that you did not kill your mother. If you will sit down, I will tell you exactly what occurred. Robert Blakiston hesitated, then retook his seat. Fraser couldn't help noticing that Joy Sunderling had twisted away from him. She looked utterly miserable and was avoiding his eye.
Let us put ourselves inside the mind of your mother, Punt continued. Again, much of this must be conjecture, but it is the only way that the events which have presented themselves to us will make any sense. She is living with a son, whom she knows to be dangerously disturbed. In her own way, she is trying to protect him. She watches his every move. She never lets him out of her sight. But as their relationship becomes more fractious and unpleasant, as the scenes between them become more violent, she gets worried. What if, in his madness, her son turns on her? She has one confidant. She looks up to Sir Magnus Pye as a man of wealth and good breeding. He is far above her, an aristocrat, no less. He has on many occasions helped with family matters. He has employed her. He has invented games for her children, keeping them amused while their father is away.
He stood by her after the breakup of her marriage, and later he has twice found work for her surviving son. He has even used his influence to extricate Robert from jail. She cannot tell him about the murder. He would be horrified and might abandon them both. But she has an idea. She gives him a sealed envelope, which contains a letter setting out the truth. The murder of her younger son, the killing of the dog, perhaps other incidents about which we will never know. She describes Robert Blakiston as he really is, but here is the trick of it. The letter is to be opened only in the event of her death. And after it has been delivered, after it has been locked away, she tells Robert exactly what she has done. The letter will act as a safety net. Sir Magnus will be true to his word. He will not open it. He will merely keep it safely. But should anything ever happen to her, should she die in strange or suspicious circumstances, then he will read it, and he will know who is responsible. It is a perfect arrangement. Robert dare not attack her. He can do her no harm. Thanks to the letter, he has been neutralized. You don't know this, Robert said. You can't know it. I know everything. Pernt paused. Let us now return to the death of Mary Blakiston and see how events unfold. Who did kill her? Chubb demanded. Nobody, Pernt smiled. That is what is so extraordinary and unfortunate about this whole affair. She really did die as a result of an accident. Nothing more. Wait a minute. Fraser spoke from the corner of the room. You told me that Matthew Blakiston killed her. He did, but not intentionally, and he was not even aware that he was responsible. You will remember, James, that he had a strange premonition that his wife was in danger and telephoned her that morning. You will also recall that the telephones in the top part of the house were not working. Lady Pye told us as much when we were with her. So what happened was very simple. Mary Blakiston was cleaning with the Hoover at the top of the stairs. The telephone rang, and she had to run all the way downstairs to answer it. Her foot caught in the wire, and she fell, dragging the Hoover with her and wedging it into the top of the banisters. It seemed obvious to me that an accident was the only sensible explanation. Mary Blakiston was alone in the house. Her keys were in the back door, which was locked, and Brent was working at the front. He would have seen anyone if they had come out. And to push somebody down the stairs? It is not a sensible way to attempt murder. How can you be sure that they will do themselves no more than a serious injury? The inhabitants of Saxby-on-Avon thought otherwise. They spoke only of murder. And to make matters worse, Mary Blakiston and her son had argued only a few days before. I wish you would die. I wish you would give me some peace. It may not have occurred to Robert immediately, but the exact conditions of his mother's letter, at least insofar as we can imagine it, had been met. She had died violently. He was the prime suspect. It was all brought home to him a week later at the funeral. The vicar has kindly lent me his sermon, and I have read his exact words. Although we are here today to mourn her departure, we should remember what she left behind. He told me that Robert was startled and covered his eyes when he heard that, and with good reason. It was not because he was upset. It was because he remembered what his mother had left behind. Fortunately, Sir Magnus and Lady Pye were not in the village. They were on holiday in the south of France. Robert had a little time, and he acted immediately. That same night, he broke into Pye Hall, using the same door that Brent had damaged when the body was found. His task was simple. He must find and destroy the letter before Sir Magnus returns. Punt looked again at Robert. You must have been furious at the unfairness of it all. You had done nothing. It was not your fault. But if the letter was read, the secrets of your childhood would be known, and the marriage would be stopped.
Now he turned to Joy, who had been listening to all this with a look of complete dismay.
I know that this cannot be easy for you, Miss Sunderling, and it gives me no pleasure to destroy your hopes. But if there is a consolation, it is that the man sitting beside you does truly love you, and did what he did in the hope that he could still be with you.
Joy Sunderling said nothing. Punt went on. Robert searched the house, but he found nothing. Sir Magnus had placed the letter in a safe in his study, along with his other private papers. The safe was concealed behind a painting and required a lengthy combination, which Robert could not possibly know. He was forced to leave empty-handed. But now he had another problem. How to explain the break-in? If nothing had been taken, Sir Magnus and the police might suspect another motivation, and when the letter came to light, that might lead them to him. The solution was simple. He opened the display case and removed the Roman silver that had once been found in Dingle Dell. He also took some of Lady Pye's jewelry. It now looked like a straightforward burglary. Of course, he had no interest in any of these items. He would not take the risk of selling them. So what did he do? He threw them into the lake, where they would have remained undiscovered, but for one piece of bad luck. He dropped a silver belt buckle as he hurried across the lawn, and the next day Brent found it and sold it to Johnny Whitehead. That led to the discovery by police divers of the rest of the hoard, and so to the true reason for the break-in. The letter remained in the safe. Sir Magnus returned from France. For the next few days, he must have had other matters to occupy him, and it cannot have been easy for you, Robert, waiting for the call that you knew must come. What would Sir Magnus do? Would he go straight to the police, or would he give you a chance to explain yourself? In the end, on the Thursday, when his wife went to London, he summoned you to Pye Hall. And so, at last, we arrive at the scene of the crime. Sir Magnus has read the letter. It is hard to be sure of his reaction. He is shocked, certainly. Does he suspect Robert Blakiston of his mother's murder? It is quite possible. But he is an intelligent, one might say, a quite diffident sort of man. He has known Robert well for many years, and he has no fear of him. Has he not always acted as Robert's mentor? However, just to be sure, he searches out his service revolver and places it in the drawer of his desk, where Inspector Chubb will find it later. It is an insurance policy, nothing more. At 7 o'clock, the garage closes. Robert returns home to wash and to change into smarter clothes for a meeting at which he intends to plead his innocence and ask for Sir Magnus's understanding. Meanwhile, other forces are at play. Matthew Blakiston is on his way from Cardiff to interrogate Sir Magnus about the treatment of his wife. Brent, who has recently been fired, works late and then goes to the ferryman. Robin Osborne has a crisis of conscience and goes to seek solace in the church. Henrietta Osborne becomes concerned and searches for her husband. Many of these paths will cross, but in such a way that no true pattern will emerge. At about 8:20, Robert makes his way to the fateful meeting. He sees the vicar's bicycle outside the church and, on a whim, decides to borrow it. He can have no way of knowing that the vicar is in fact inside the church. He arrives, unseen, at Pye Hall, parks the bicycle at the lodge and walks up the drive. He is admitted by Sir Magnus. And what takes place, the actual murder itself, I will describe in a minute. But first let me complete the larger picture. Matthew Blakiston also arrives and parks his car beside the lodge, at the same time noticing the bicycle. He walks up the driveway and is seen by Brent, who is just finishing work. He knocks at the door, which is opened a few moments later by Sir Magnus. You will remember, Fraser, the exchange which took place and which was described to us quite accurately by Matthew Blakiston. You! Sir Magnus is surprised, and with good reason. The father has arrived at the very moment when the son is inside, and the two of them are engaged in a discussion of the greatest delicacy. Sir Magnus does not say his name out loud. He does not wish to alert Robert to the fact that his father is here at the worst possible time. But before he dismisses him, he uses the opportunity to ask Matthew a question. Do you really think I killed your dog? Why would he ask such a thing unless he was wishing to confirm something he had been discussing with Robert just moments before? At any event, Sir Magnus closes the door. Matthew leaves. The murder takes place. Robert Blakiston hurries from the house, using the bicycle that he has borrowed. It is dark. He does not expect to meet anyone. Inside the ferryman, Brent hears the bicycle go past during a lull in the music and assumes it is the vicar. Robert replaces the bicycle at the church, but there has been a great deal of blood, and he has managed to transfer some of it to the handlebars. When the vicar comes out of the church and returns home on the bicycle, some of that blood will surely be found on his clothes. It is why I believe Mrs. Osborne was so very nervous when she spoke to me. It may well be that she believed him to be guilty of the crime. Well, they will know the truth soon enough. There is one last act in the drama of the night. Matthew Blakiston has changed his mind and returns to have his confrontation with Sir Magnus. He misses his son by a matter of minutes, but sees the dead body through the letterbox and collapses into the flower bed, leaving a print of his hand in the soft earth. Afraid that he will be suspected, he leaves as quickly as he can, but he is spotted by Lady Pye, who has just returned from London, and who will now enter the house and find her husband. That leaves only the murder itself, which I must now describe. Robert Blakiston and Sir Magnus Pye meet in the study. Sir Magnus has retrieved the letter that Mary Blakiston wrote all those years ago, and you will recall that the picture which covers the safe is still ajar. The letter is on his desk, and the two men discuss its contents. Robert urges Sir Magnus to believe that he has done nothing wrong, that he was not responsible for his mother's tragic death. As chance would have it, there is a second letter, also on the desk. Sir Magnus has received it that day. It concerns the demolition of Dingle Dell, and contains some threatening, even some violent, language. As we now know, it was written by a local woman, Diana Weaver, using the typewriter of Dr. Redwing. Two letters, two envelopes. Remember this. The conversation does not go well. It may be that Sir Magnus threatens to expose his former protégé. Perhaps he says he will consider the matter before he goes to the police. I would imagine that Robert is at his most charming and persuasive as Sir Magnus shows him out. But when he reaches the main hall, he strikes. He has already noted the suit of armor, and he draws the sword from its sheath. It comes out silently and easily because, as it happens, Sir Magnus has used it quite recently when he attacked the portrait of his wife. Robert is taking no chances. He will not be exposed. His marriage to Joyce Sunderling will go ahead. From behind, he decapitates Sir Magnus, then returns to the study to get rid of the evidence. But this is where he makes his two critical mistakes. He crumples up his mother's letter and burns it in the fire. At the same time, he manages to get some of Sir Magnus's blood onto the paper, and this is what we will later find. But much worse than that, he burns the wrong envelope. I knew at once that an error had been made, and not only because Mrs. Weaver's letter had been produced on a typewriter, while the surviving envelope was handwritten. No. The envelope was addressed quite formally to Sir Magnus Pye, and this was completely out of character with its contents. The correspondent had referred to him as "you bastard." She had threatened to kill him.
Would she then have written Sir Magnus on the envelope? I did not think so, and intended to ask Mrs. Weaver this, but unfortunately I was taken ill before I could put the question to her. It does not matter. We have the envelope, and we have the diary written by Mary Blakiston. As I remarked to Fraser, the writing on both was the same. Punt had drawn to a halt. There was to be no dramatic conclusion, no final declamation. That had never been his style. Chubb shook his head.
"Robert Blakiston," he intoned, "I am arresting you for murder."
He continued with a formal warning, then added,
"Is there anything you want to say?"
For the last few minutes, Blakiston had been staring at a fixed point on the floor, as if he could find his whole future there. But suddenly he looked up, and there were tears streaming from his eyes. At that moment, Fraser could very easily imagine him as the 14-year-old child who had killed his brother in a rage and who had been hiding from that crime ever since. He turned to Joy. He spoke only to her.
"I did it for you, my darling," he said. "Meeting you was the best thing that ever happened to me, and I knew I could only be completely happy with you. I wasn't going to let anyone take that away from me, and I'd do it again if I had to. I'd do it for you."
Chapter 4. From the Times, August 1955. The death of Atticus Punt has been widely reported in the British press, but I wonder if I might add a few words of my own, as I knew him perhaps better than anyone, having worked for him for 6 years in the capacity of personal assistant. I first met Mr. Punt when I replied to an advertisement placed in the Spectator magazine. It stated that a businessman, recently arrived from Germany, required the services of a confidential secretary to assist him with typing, administration, and associated duties. It is revealing that he did not refer to himself as an investigator or private detective, even though he already had a formidable reputation, particularly following the recovery of the Ludendorff diamond and the spectacular series of arrests that followed. Mr. Punt was always modest. Although he helped the police on numerous occasions, including the recent murder of a wealthy landowner in the Wiltshire village of Saxby-on-Avon, he preferred to remain in the shadows, seldom taking the credit for what he had achieved. There has been some speculation about the manner of his death, and I wish to set the record straight. It is true that Mr. Punt had come into possession of a large dose of the poison physostigmine during his last investigation, and that he should, of course, have returned it to the police. He did not, because he had already decided to take his own life, as he made clear in a letter which he had left behind, and which was forwarded to me after his cremation. Although I had not been aware of it, Mr. Punt had been diagnosed with a particularly malignant form of brain tumour, which would have ended his life shortly anyway, and he had chosen to prevent himself unnecessary suffering. He was the kindest and the wisest man I ever knew. His experiences in Germany, before and during the war, had given him a perspective that must have aided him in his work. He had an innate understanding of evil, and was able to root it out with unerring precision. Although we spent much time together, he had few friends, and I cannot pretend that I completely understood the workings of his remarkable mind. He made it clear that he wanted no monument left behind, but requested that his ashes should be scattered close to Saxby-on-Avon in Dingle Dell, the woodland that he in part helped to save. That said, I am in possession of all the pages, notes, and material relating to the treatise which occupied much of his later life, a major work entitled The Landscape of Criminal Investigation. It is a tragedy that it remains unfinished, but I have forwarded everything that I have been able to find to Professor Crina Hutton at the Oxford Centre for Criminology, and it is very much my hope that this landmark volume will be made available to the public soon. James Fraser.
Ios Nikolaos, Crete. There's not much more to add. Cloverleaf Books folded, which is about as apt a description as you can get for a publishing firm going out of business. It was all very messy, with Charles in jail, and the insurers refusing to pay out for the building, which had been completely destroyed in the fire. Our successful authors jumped ship as fast as they could, which was a little disappointing, but not entirely surprising. You don't want to be published by someone who might murder you. I no longer had a job, of course. Sitting at home after I had got out of hospital, I was surprised to learn that I was getting some of the blame for what had happened. It's like I said in the beginning, Charles Clover was entrenched in the publishing industry, and the general feeling was that I had betrayed him. After all, he had published Graham Greene, Anthony Burgess, and Muriel Spark, and he had only ever killed one writer, Alan Conway, a well-known pain in the neck. Had it really been necessary to make such a fuss about his death when he was going to die anyway? Nobody actually put this into so many words, but when I finally limped out to a few literary events, a conference, a book launch, that was the feeling I got. The Women's Prize for Fiction decided not to have me as a judge after all. I wished they could have seen Charles as I had finally seen him, preparing to burn me alive and kicking me so hard that he broke my ribs. I wasn't going back to work any time soon. I no longer had a heart for it, and anyway, my vision hadn't recovered. That remains the case. I'm not quite as blind as poor Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre, but my eyes tire if I read too much, and the words move around on the page. These days, I prefer audiobooks. I've gone back to 19th century literature. I avoid whodunits. I live in Ios Nikolaos in Crete. The decision was more or less made for me in the end. There was nothing to keep me in London. A lot of my friends had turned their backs on me, and Andreas was leaving whatever happened. I would have been a fool not to go with him, and my sister Katie spent at least a week telling me exactly that. At the end of the day, I was in love with him. I'd come to realize that when I was sitting on my own at Bradford-on-Avon station, and it had certainly been confirmed when he had appeared as my knight in shining armor, battling his way through the blaze to rescue me. If anything, he should have been the one who had second thoughts. I didn't speak a word of Greek. I wasn't much of a cook. My vision was impaired. What possible use could I be? I did say some of this to him, and his response was to take me out to the Greek restaurant in Crouch End, to produce a diamond ring, which was much more than he could afford, and to go down on one knee in front of all the diners. I was horrified, and couldn't accept fast enough, just to get him to behave properly back on his feet. He didn't need a bank loan in the end. I sold my flat, and although he wasn't entirely happy about it, I insisted on investing some of the money in Hotel Polydorus, making myself an equal partner. It was probably madness, but after what I'd been through, I didn't really care. It wasn't just that I'd almost been killed. It was that everything I trusted and believed in had been taken away from me. I felt that my life had been unraveled as quickly and as absolutely as Atticus Punt's name. Does that make sense? It was as if my new life was an anagram of my old one, and I would only learn what shape it had taken when I began to live it. 2 years have passed since I left England. Polydorus hasn't actually made a profit yet, but guests seem to like it, and we've been full for most of this season, so we must be doing something right. The hotel is on the edge of Ios Nikolaos, which is a bright, shabby, colourful town with too many shops selling trinkets and tourist tat, but it's authentic enough to make you feel it's somewhere you want to live. We're right on the seafront, and I never tire of gazing at the water, which is a quite dazzling blue, and makes the Mediterranean look like a puddle. The kitchen and reception area open onto a stone terrace, where we have a dozen tables. We're open for breakfast, lunch and dinner. And we serve simple, fresh, local food. Andreas works in the kitchen. His cousin Yanis does almost nothing, but he's well connected. They call it Visma, and comes into his own with local PR. And then there's Philippos, Alexandros, Georgios, Nell, and all the other family and friends who bundle in to help us during the day and who sit drinking rookie with us until late into the night. I could write about it, and maybe one day I will. A middle-aged woman takes the plunge and moves in with her Greek lover and his eccentric family, various cats, neighbors, suppliers and guests, making a go of it in the Aegean sunshine. There used to be a market for that sort of thing, although, of course, I won't be able to write the full truth, not if I want to sell. There's still a part of me that misses Crouch End, and I miss publishing. Andreas and I are always worrying about money, and that puts a strain on us. Life may imitate art, but it usually falls short of it. The strange thing is that Magpie Murders did get published in the end. After the collapse of Cloverleaf, a few of our titles were picked up by other publishers, including the entire Atticus Punt series, which, as it happened, went to my old firm, Orion Books. They reissued it with new covers and brought out Magpie Murders at the same time. By now, the whole world knew the nasty truth behind the detective's name. But in the long term, it didn't matter. All the publicity about the real-life murder and the trial made people more interested in the book. And I wasn't surprised to see it on the bestseller lists. Robert Harris gave it a very good review in the Sunday Times. I even saw a copy the other day as I walked along the beach. A woman was sitting in a deck chair reading it, and there was Alan Conway staring out at me from the back cover. Seeing him, I felt a spurt of real anger. I remembered what Charles had said about Alan, how he had selfishly, needlessly spoiled the pleasure of millions of people who had enjoyed the Atticus Punt novels. He was right. I had been one of them. And just for a moment, I imagined that it was I, not Charles, who had been on the tower at Abbey Grange, shoving out with both hands, pushing Alan to his death. I could actually see myself doing it. It was exactly what he deserved. I had been the detective, and now I was the murderer. And do you know? I think I liked it more.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Magpie Murders by Anthony Horowitz, performed by Samantha Bond and Alan Corduna. This program was produced and engineered by Nicholas Jones and edited by Wolfgang Dietz. Executive producer Pandora White. Text copyright 2016 by Anthony Horowitz. Production copyright 2016 by Orion Publishing Group, a Hachette UK company. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.